Welcome to Jewish History Soundbites podcast with Yehuda Geber. Immerse yourself in the rich tapestry of Jewish history as we explore fascinating tales and uncover hidden gems from our glorious past. Brought to you by our proud sponsor, Cross River, a leader at the intersection of financial services and technology, committed to empowering the communities they serve. Cross River's steadfast support fuels our mission to preserve our heritage and foster a vibrant future for all. Contact Cross River through their website at crossriver.com.
A date which will live in infamy.
Both of those projects, initiatives, got off the ground because of the Gerer Rebbe.
The 11 Olympic team members slain in West Germany. The Olympic Games.
So gereicht waren die Brüder in Amerika. So tausend Schabes at the Skizzer.
Out of the 24 who were killed were Americans who had come to learn in Hebron.
I say 1 million Jewish children who were made to be cut loose.
Whoever heard such beautiful words, Adonavecho Talmud Bavli.
It is never too little, it is never too late, and it is never enough.
Jewish History Soundbites, bringing alive the world of our glorious past. Here is our host, live from Jerusalem, Jewish historian and tour guide.
We're with Jewish History Soundbites, and it's been a while, been busy, Purim and things like that, but this episode is going to be good and interesting, engaging, and providing a new way of thinking about an old story. So I believe that everyone will agree that it was worth the wait. And this, what we're going to talk about, is still focusing on different angles of Jewish life and Jewish history in the Russian Empire of the 19th century under the Tsars. And this time I'm going to focus on the Lithuanian world of the Lamdan, of the rabbinical elite, the yeshiva elite in Lithuanian society and in the Russian Empire. Obviously, it's not Lithuania as a political entity, it's as a geographical one. Uriel Gelman has an excellent essay in that book that I keep on referring to, but there's many other sources, obviously, on it as well. Now, if this would simply be a profile or profiles of specific yeshivas or personalities associated with the Litvisha Lamdan scholarly elite, or more generally the yeshiva movement as it developed in the 19th century, then it would be more of an internal story and doesn't belong in the context of the story of the Jews in the Russian Empire. What does that have to do with the Russian Empire? I mean, it happened to be that it was in Russia, but it's a separate story. And I've covered that story quite extensively in a variety of episodes on this podcast over the years. So it would seem to be, why are you returning to this topic? What place does it have in this series, in this general narrative? It would be a story regarding famous people and institutions in yeshivas in the Lithuanian context. So how does it really fit in here? So I think we need to take a step. We don't need to. We can take a step back for a broader perspective on the phenomenon of the Litvish yeshiva, the Litvish scholarly Lamdan ideal, and its their place in society, and the structures and personalities of how it developed and how that was impacted by the general trends of Russian Jewish society under the Tsars in the 19th century, and which eventually emerged as the product that we know of it today, the yeshiva community that we associate with today in today's current contemporary society in the United States and Israel and other places, is very much a byproduct of what took place in Russia in the Pale, that developed the yeshiva community, the yeshiva system that we know. So I want to explain all that. Let's go through the story itself. In the Lithuanian regions of the old Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the old Polish-Lithuanian Kingdom, prior to the partitions. So there's this Jewish societal elite in those Lithuanian regions, before it's subsumed into the Russian Empire, before the partitions. There's this, in the Kahal, in the Kahilas, in the Jewish communities, there's this oligarchy of a tiny minority of society composed of the rabbinical and financial elite. The two forces which basically were joined together, and they formed the ruling component of the Kehila, which for the most part, they're a small group of miyuchas families, they had good lineage of very old rabbinical and financially comfortable families, and they continually married into each other generation after generation. Again, I'm talking about the old Polish kingdom here, the Lithuanian areas of the old Polish kingdom. The Jewish masses in the communities were not part of this elite. So this structure was on the cusp of change. And the main changes of the upcoming 19th century, aside from the fact that it would now be Russia and not the old Polish kingdom anymore after the partitions, but those changes would fundamentally change the power structure of these elites. And that would be through the weakening and then eventually the annulment of the Kahal. First, the weakening of the Kahal. Even earlier, the larger autonomous bodies governing Jewish internal affairs, the Vad Arba Ratzes, Vad Medinas Lita, was annulled in the 1760s, 1764. The Kahal was annulled. That's already when it's the Polish kingdom. The Kahal itself is annulled by the Tsarist government in 1844. I think I've mentioned that before. The changes of the 19th century were also more fundamental in the fact that there was the migration to the cities, urbanization, changing economic circumstances, which had a great effect on the Kahal and the power structure therein. And perhaps most decisively, what's going to happen in the 19th century, especially the second half of the 19th century, is secularization. And secularization often starts among the financial elite. So there goes half the elite, right? Not suddenly, obviously, this is all a gradual process. So the rabbinical, scholarly, Lumden section of the elite was no longer supported financially by the other half. Once secularization kicks in, or had eligible marriage partners for their children in the financial elite. So this leads to a breaking down, all these factors lead to a breaking down of the historic elite of the community over the course of the 19th century in Russia. The Lumden, the scholar, the Torah scholar, as the elite of Jewish society, does remain a very Litvish ideal, and perhaps it's even enhanced because as there's less and less official Kahal establishment elitism as the 19th century progresses, so this Lamdan elitism emerges as a quasi-meritocracy because he's a genuine, authentic Lamdan and the community looks up to him, or at least the traditional community that's not secularized yet looks up to the Lamdan, looks up to the rabbinical elite, to the Torah scholar. And also, obviously, because of the singular and completely unparalleled long-term impact of the Vilna Gaon on Lithuanian Jewish society and identity in the 19th century. Remember, he passed away in 1797, right after the partitions were finished. So by the time he passes away, he's passing away in Vilna, which is now in Russia, in the Russian Empire. So the Vilna Gaon has this incredible impact on, as one person, as one personality on Lithuanian society, and as the who's looked at as the elite, the Torah scholar, the Lamdan. So in order to understand the context correctly, it's important to emphasize that the idea of the Litvish Lamdan Torah scholar belongs to a distinct tiny minority and was very far from some sort of widespread thing that is sometimes romanticized in contemporary literature. So almost all members of the Lithuanian Jewish society did not attend yeshiva, almost none. Some were illiterate entirely. Men, right, for sure, women, for the most part, were. But what is an established fact is how this elite, even though it was tiny and it did not belong to the masses, but it was a status, and it was recognized as such a status across wide swaths of Lithuanian society, and earned an everlasting reputation as some sort of ideal in that society. No, meaning that the, despite the fact that it only belonged to a very small elite, but the masses did respect it, or at least the traditional masses, as the 19th century progressed, respected it and looked up to it, and it was a status in that society, by way of showing how it remains with us until today, at least in Israel. I don't know if it's like this in other countries, but in Israel, where I live, it is. Today, if someone is referred to as a Lithuanian, Litai, it does not mean someone from the geographic place called Lithuania. It rather means someone who's, regardless of his country of origin, it's someone who identifies with the current Lithuanian ideal of Torah scholarship and the institutional symbol of that community, namely the yeshiva. So if you identify with the ideal of Torah scholarship and you identify with the yeshiva community, then poof, you're a Litvak, you're Lithuanian. So it has nothing to do with which country you came from. It's become a synonymous with an ideological belonging and the Torah scholarly elitism. So the ideological goal with lots of practical benefits which fed this system historically were the prestige, the status within the community, wealth historically, again, through marital connections to the wealthy oligarchy of the Kehillah, a good shidduch, good job in the rabbinate, very often the prospects initially. As the 19th century progressed, that also became more problematic, that we'll see also soon. And the status in the community, who, as mentioned, though rarely belonged to the Lamdan elite, but the ideological valuing of Torah study and respect for its scholars was rather universal in Lithuanian Jewish society, at least until the mid-19th century. A major development, as I mentioned, in the history of the ethos, ideology, imagery, visualization or legacy of the Torah scholarship aristocracy in Lithuania was the personality and life story of the Vilna Gaon, the Gro, Rabbi Leo Kramer, the Vilna Gaon. Debatable if his name was actually Kramer or not, but Rabbi Leo, the Gaon of Vilna. I spoke about this at length on a podcast a few years ago devoted to the legacy and historical impact of the Vilna Gaon, but I want to briefly analyze it in a slightly broader context because I'm trying to get to a much broader point here. As an individual, as one person, the Vilna Gaon was seen as someone who, number one, had lived a life of complete and total devotion to the study of Torah. Number two, had a complete and total knowledge of all of Torah in the most broad definition conceivable of that term. Number three, he was considered by his students as Hagoyin HaChassid. He was considered a mystic, a Kabbalist, and as someone who sacrificed all of his physical needs to lead an aesthetic lifestyle, barely sleeping, barely eating, in order to maximize his complete devotion to Torah study. Number four, he never held any official position in any establishment institution in the community at all. All of his leadership and influence, and even in his own lifetime, which is also quite rare, was purely through his personal charisma and the respect and awe that the community had for his Torah scholarship and achievements, and he was therefore also financially supported by the Vilna Kahal. Number five, his opposition to the nascent Hasidic movement. He was the one who spearheaded and initiated its excommunication, the extreme opposition. So the movement of the Misnagdim is attributed to his legacy as well. Number six, his students who published his Torah, adopted his customs, most of whom who eventually immigrated to Eretz Yisrael in the early 1800s, but others who remained, and especially his prime student, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, both through his literary legacy of Nefesh HaChaim and the physical institution which he established with the Volozhin Yeshiva. Those are the main points of the Vilna Gaon as one person. Taken together, if we take all those points together, the Litvish Lamdan legacy is to a great extent cemented by the personality and legacy of the Vilna Gaon himself. The Volozhin Yeshiva, which was established by his student, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, was revolutionary in the respect that it was not a Kehila Yeshiva. It did not belong to a specific community. It was a non-Kehila. It had no borders. It was Russia's Yeshiva. It belonged to the Jews of the Pale of Settlement across the entire Pale. It was not specifically a Volozhin or one Kehila. Its organizational structure and funding were not dependent on the local community. And that's what made it the first modern yeshiva. That's what made it the mother of all modern yeshivas today. I explored the fascinating history of the Volozhin Yeshiva in a five-part series on this podcast several years ago. So if you either didn't listen to it yet, which is hard to believe, then you should go ahead and do so. And if you did, you may want to review it. I will try to remember this time to post the links to everything, because I always promise to do so and I never do. So I'm going to try to remember to do that this time. All of the above is well known. I don't think anything I said so far should be any, you know, earth-shattering news. I just needed to explain all that to get to a broader point. Really, what does this all have to do with the history of Russian Jewry under the Tsars? I think we can take a step back and try to see how this plays out over the 19th century. And here's how I'd like to break it down. We tend to see a linear path in the development of the yeshiva world from Volozhin until today, a historical linear path. So first of all, it's important to emphasize that there's nothing that's a linear path. Almost never in history is anything a linear path. That's important to emphasize. But it's also important to emphasize that the whole Volozhin and yeshiva movement story takes place in the Russian Tsarist Empire of the long 19th century. The long 19th century, like I said, goes all the way to the First World War. So, and then subsequently, even after that, in the Second Polish Republic, between the wars, because most of the Lithuanian-style yeshivas end up in the Second Polish Republic. Some of them end up in independent Lithuania, definitely none of them in the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union stamps out religion to the best that they can. So this is definitely a Russian story, whether we like it or not, because it took place in Russia, and then later on in Poland after World War I. Outside of Russia and other countries, there were other stories of yeshivas developing, growing, shrinking, disappearing, continuing in other countries as a movement or not as a movement, and that was all completely independent of the Volozhin Russia story. We shouldn't ignore the rest of the world. In Hungary, there was a yeshiva movement. In Germany, there was rise and falls of yeshivas. Even in places like Italy and Western Europe, there were yeshivas. The land of Israel, there were yeshivas. Across the Ottoman Empire, in Iraq and Syria and Turkey and Greece and Morocco and many other countries, there were plenty of yeshivas in different forms and shapes and sizes and different structures. So we're not ignoring that and not saying that this was the yeshiva thing. This was the yeshiva story in Russia. So we're talking about the yeshiva story in Russia. So it is important to emphasize that. Secondly, and more importantly, there is no linear development of this so-called movement, yeshiva movement. It's a crooked path, not linear, with lots of factors coming into play. And it only becomes somewhat of a movement at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. In other words, I would say by the early 1900s, maybe you can call it a movement by then. Maybe. In other words, a century following the establishment of Volozhin. 1802, Volozhin is established by Reb Chaim Volozhiner. It does not become a yeshiva movement until the early 1900s. And that's after Volozhin itself is closed down. Volozhin is closed down in 1892. So what's the story here? So historically speaking, we can ask a few questions. Did Volozhin Yeshiva spawn a movement soon after its founding for the establishment of other similar style yeshivas? Remember, it's a modern yeshiva. It's modern in its structure, in its organizational structure, and it's not being a Kehila yeshiva. It doesn't belong to the community. The way it's funded, the way its students come, it's completely a new type of yeshiva, which almost all yeshivas today are similarly styled on that. So, which as I discussed in that series, did the Volozhin Yeshiva spawn a movement soon after its founding for the establishment of other similar style yeshivas? Remember, a Volozhin style yeshiva would be characterized as a non-Kehila yeshiva. If we phrase the question differently, did alumni of Volozhin, this is a historical question, This is not an ideological one. Did alumni of Elazhin become rabbis and teachers of Torah in a variety of communities and institutions over 19th century across Russia? So I asked the question differently this time. Again, did alumni of Elazhin become rabbis and teachers of Torah in a variety of communities and institutions over the 19th century across Russia? The answer is unequivocally a resounding yes. So the second way I asked the question is yes, and therefore Elazhin had a huge influence and impact right away. So we have to phrase the question correctly. Did the vision of Reb Chaim Elazhiner, as expressed through the establishment of Elazhin Yeshiva, help generate a Torah movement, a movement that enlarged the engagement of Torah study? Yes, it did. If we would say it the old way, did it generate a yeshiva movement modeled on the unique institution of his own Elazhin Yeshiva, which was a trailblazing institution? No, or not quite, at least not right away. It did not generate a yeshiva movement. So you have to know which question to ask. And there are two angles that this can be approached. Number one, what did and did not happen following the founding of yeshiva, of the Elazhin Yeshiva in 1802 until the 1870s regarding the type of yeshivas which were and were not founded? And number two, what happened from the 1870s and on in the realm of the establishment of yeshivas in the Lithuanian areas of Russia on the model of Elazhin Yeshiva, and why did it happen at that particular moment in history? So in order to answer those questions, we have to mention a myth and bust the myth and explain why it's not true. There's a myth that following the establishment of the Elazhin Yeshiva by Reb Chaim Elazhiner in 1802, many others copied his example and other similar yeshivas were established across the Pale of Settlement. And this is known as the yeshiva movement. The truth of the matter is, aside from the Mir Yeshiva, which was founded in either 1815, 1817, it seems a bit of a dispute, but aside from the Mir, to the best of my knowledge, no other Elazhin Yeshiva style, Elazhin style non-Kehila yeshivas were founded until the mid-1870s, which is a period of about 60 years. 70, mid-1870s, from 1802 to 1870s. So like 75 years that I know of, besides for the Mir. So you have a period for about over 70 years from the founding of Elazhin. So besides for the Mir, no other Elazhin-style non-Kehila yeshivas were founded in Russia that I know of. And even in the 1870s, it took quite some time until it could possibly be considered a movement. So the Telz Yeshiva was founded, Radin, a couple of others. But until it could be considered a movement, probably not till the 1900s. So it takes a full century for this movement to kind of take off, which begs the question, why? Why does it take so long? So we have to understand a little bit more of the history of Torah study in Russia under the Tsars. There are quite a few yeshivas across the Pale, many of them established even by alumni of Elazhin and inspired by Reb Chaim Elazhiner. But for the most part, these were non-Elazhin style yeshivas. They were at most a Kehila yeshiva for locals, and usually not even that, usually an old style Beis Medrash type of study. What was the Beis Medrash model? Beis Medrash model was very simply locals of all ages, post cheder, after 12, 13 year olds and up, local students, teenagers, sometimes married young men who were living by their father-in-laws and supported by them. They would study independently, in other words, each one on their own. No one would study together. They would study different subjects, a variety of subjects, in a local Beis Medrash in the town, pretty much on their own. Everyone just was studying. The community or individual families provided them with nominal support. The local rabbi would make himself available for them to discuss things and learning on their subjective subject matter, perhaps occasionally deliver a shiur on whatever he chose, not connected at all to whatever the local students and young scholars were each studying, because each of them were studying different random things. And then there was the Kehila yeshiva model, which I mentioned, which was a bit more structured, but not overly so, and in many ways was quite similar to the Beis Medrash model. The community generally funded the Kehila yeshiva. The community, the Kehillah Yeshiva was generally hosted in a local shul. The rabbi of the community, under his rabbinical contract, was generally obligated to have an active relationship with the local yeshiva. And the kahal, the community, generally capped the number of students they would support in that yeshiva, in that same contract with the rabbi. Sometimes, if the rabbi was a bit more charismatic communal rabbi, then the yeshiva, under the community's infrastructure, would attract more students, maybe even from out of town. But both of these models, the local Kehillah yeshiva and the Beis Medrash model, were fundamentally different from the modern yeshiva model of a Lajin, in structure, in curriculum, in organization, in style of learning, in staff, in everything, and most importantly, in funding. That was the biggest difference. So yes, there were students of Alajin who became rabbis in various towns across the Pale, alumni of Alajin. In many of these towns, such as Slutsk, in Minsk, there was a few yeshivas, Blumka's Kloys, a few others, in Kreis, in Vilna, there were a few Kehillah yeshivas, the Ramayla's yeshiva, Rabbi Yaakov Barit had a yeshiva in Vilna, also the Chavetz Chaim studied there. In Aishishok, they had like this kibbutz, Beis Medrash yeshiva, and many other towns. Yeshivas were established, which were the old model, pre-Valajin style, Kehillah yeshivas, or Batei Medrash, as described. This was not the Valajin style yeshiva, which was such a trailblazing, pioneering, and ultimately, over 100 years later, successful endeavor, successful institution, successful at being a model institution for others to copy. So again, more Torah study and more Torah scholars as a result of Alajin. Yes, more yeshivas inspired by the new modern model and a yeshiva movement? Nope. At least not until the 1870s and not really until later. Why not? And what happened later that all of a sudden it did change? So here's where it connects to the larger story of Russian Jewry under the Tsars. Volozhin at its peak had about 400 students. Mir had fewer during the 19th century, the pre-Finkel era, the Tikhtinsky era. They had a couple of hundred students. So a total of a few hundred. Now, there were, you know, depending on when in the 19th century, but there's 3, 4, 5 million Jews living in the Russian Empire at different times during the 19th century in Russia. So until the 1870s and 1880s, secularization, though it already existed, it was not incredibly widespread. So there's millions of Jews living in Russia in, let's say, mid-century. For the most part, still traditional. Secularization did not make major inroads until late in the 19th century in Russia. So what's going on? Where did everyone study Torah? We said the Volozhin and Mir had just a couple of hundred students. And there's millions of Jews in Russia, and most of them are traditional. So the partial answer is what we said before, the old school model of the Kehillah yeshivas and the old school model of the Batei Medrash still flourished throughout the 19th century. They did not disappear. Not only in Galicia among Hasidim, it was actually so in Lithuanian areas of Russia as well throughout the entire 19th century. In fact, yeshivas emerged more as a widespread in a movement among the Lithuanian Jewish population at just about the same time that Hasidim were turning towards yeshiva education as well. We'll see, we'll talk about that soon. And we'll also see that it was for remarkably similar reasons. So it's interesting, we tend to think that the yeshiva movement started in the Lithuanian communities much earlier than Hasidim. As a movement, not really. It was almost the same time and for very similar reasons. We'll see that soon. Maybe I'll elaborate on that soon if we have time. But much more common than this partial answer of the students studying in Batei Medrash and local Kehillah yeshivas, and much more common was the fact that it was simply not financially feasible for long-term Torah study for the youth of Russia to take place altogether. Nearly all Jewish youth in the Pale ended their formal Torah education at around Bar Mitzvah age or sooner when they were in Cheder. Only three small categories of youth continued their Torah studies after 12, 13 years old. Number one, children of the financial elite. Number two, children of rabbis. And number three, the occasional gifted ilui, the type of child one encounters in storybooks, where a child is just destined for greatness and either found a patron individual or a patron community, or somehow persevered in destitute poverty, continuing his studies with great dedication. You have occasionally stories like that. Everyone else went to work. Everyone else, life in the Pale under the Tsars was just too hard and did not allow most of the youth the financial luxury of long-term Torah study. So it simply did not exist for the most part. They already were trying, becoming shoemakers and water carriers and craftsmen and peddlers and whatever else the economic reality of life in the Pale was. So therefore, that's where everyone was. That's what happened until the 1870s. Why did Volozhin-style yeshivas start to flourish from the mid-1870s through the early 1900s? What happened all of a sudden in the 1870s? Now there's this flourishing. Radin tells Slabatka, another Slabatka, there are two yeshivas in Slabatka, the Kovna Kail. Kelm also was around, but that's really a different story. It was much smaller. It was a Musar place. It's a different story. Navardik, Malch, Slutsk, Lida, Panovich, a few others. Like I said, Mir already existed before. What happens all of a sudden? Why in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, there's all of a sudden 10 new yeshivas that open up, modeled on the Volozhin model of the modern yeshiva? So there are several factors in the broader context of Russian Jewry. And a confluence of these factors leads to the rise of the Volozhin-style Lithuanian yeshivas. None of them had to do with Volozhin per se. One could actually say that the Volozhin model just happened to be at the right place at the right time of history, and it conveniently served as a solution to a number of issues facing Russian Jewry, and the Volozhin yeshiva model facilitated a good response of the traditional community to challenges that they were facing. And Volozhin happened to be around, and the people were like, wow, this is a great idea. If we model a yeshiva like this, this could help our situation. It was almost like good luck or hashgacha pratis, or it just was there. It was not that it was planned to become movement at the outset. And that's why in the 1870s, there's this flourishing, and that's why by the 1900s, one could say that it's actually a movement that took off. So what are those factors that facilitated this growth? The main one is confronting the challenges of modernity. This isn't one thing, but obviously a combination of many processes of the 19th century. The Haskalah Mita'am, the Tsarist government during the reigns of Nicholas I and Alexander II. We discussed this in previous episodes, that the Russian government tries to enforce all kinds of changes in the rabbinical structure, in education, in the integration of Jews in the Pale into Russian society. Number two, the annulment of the Kahal by the Tsarist government in 1844. Number three, rising secularization, especially towards the end of the 19th century. Number four, rising revolutionary movements and nationalist movements within the Jewish community towards the end of the 19th century. Number five, the Industrial Revolution, urbanization, and migration. And these huge changes are rocking the very foundations of traditional Jewish life in Russia. So that's one factor as a whole. I mean, it's like 10 or 12 different things that I mentioned, but there's maybe not 10, I mentioned 6 or 7, whatever it is. There's all these challenges of modernity. Another factor is the rise of the Musar movement of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Also not much of a movement, at least not a mass movement, but we'll call it a movement for argument's sake. And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's movement was a direct response to the challenge of Haskalah Mitam in the 1840s, but it had nothing to do with the yeshiva world, and it had nothing to do with the Torah institutions in its initial stages. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and he's worth a podcast, it's hard to believe we never did one on him and his Musar movement, we got to do a series on that one day, but Rabbi Yisrael Salanter intended it for the layman, for the average Lithuanian balabas in Lithuania, the working man. And it only penetrated the yeshiva, the Musar movement only penetrated the yeshiva community two generations later with the opening of Slabatka by the altar of Slabatka and later Novardik by the altar of Novardik. And then it also spread to Telz, Radin, Mir and some of the other new yeshivas. So that's another factor, because the Musar movement became a very good partner to the emerging new type of yeshiva. Another factor is the collapse of the old social elite. which I mentioned at the outset of this episode, the old Kahal oligarchy between the financial and rabbinical scholarly elite almost completely disappeared by the end of the 19th century. The financial elite, like I said, were usually the quickest to secularize, and this had a twofold impact on the growth of the Torah world. Number one, the financial support within the Kahal was gone, both at the leadership institutional level, as well as the marriages which had taken place between the rabbinical elite and the financial elite for centuries. So all that was gone, the financial support. Number two, anyone who is still identified with traditional Judaism in the face of the onslaught of modernity and secularism now identified with the Torah elite exclusively in the Lithuanian parts of Russia. So the solution to all of the above issues, challenges, factors was the rise of the Volozhin style non-Kahili yeshiva. Because the financial burden was never carried by an individual Kahal, but by the Jews across the Pale who still identified with traditional Judaism. And even beyond the Pale, or even beyond the borders of Russia, once the great immigration of Russian Jews to other countries began, then fundraising can go on across the world. And these non-Kahila yeshiva institutions modeled on Volozhin emerged as citadels of Torah, islands of tradition, symbols of the Torah community, which was on the defensive in this modern world, which was changing so fast. So these new institutions could sustain themselves in more effective ways than the old Kahal yeshivas or Batei Medrash. They would be independent. They, in their prestige, could replace the weakened Kahal. They, especially with the incorporation of the ideology and methods of the Musar movement towards the end of the century, can serve as bulwarks for the traditional and rabbinical elite and produce Torah leaders for an embattled traditional community amid a tidal wave of secularization. And in summary, it was really outside factors which leads to the rise of the Volozhin style non-Kahili yeshiva in Russia. And these factors were distinctly Tsarist Russian 19th century issues. And the Volozhin model served as a feasible solution, or at least so was thought. It still was a far cry from some sort of mass movement. And it was only a handful of yeshivas with a couple of thousand students at most, even at the turn of the century, in a population of 5 million Jews in Russia. So it's still hard to really call it a yeshiva movement. So still, there's much secularization, much poverty, so early working. And yes, there are still Kahili yeshivas and Batei Medrash, even at this late stage. But at the same time, the Volozhin non-Kahila model of the yeshiva was spreading at the turn of the century and could eventually be referred to as a movement and as a standard model for new yeshivas. There's a couple of additional points that I want to make for this to wrap up the ends of this story. Number one, most rabbis across Russia, even Litvish ones, did not graduate from Volozhin or Mir in the 19th century, for pretty much the entire century. The average rabbi in the Pale of Settlement was a graduate of a Kahili yeshiva or Beis Medrash model, who had studied for a time under a prominent rabbinical authority in practical rabbinics in order to receive his rabbinical certification, which would assist his prospects in getting a job in the rabbinate. Only a few rabbis came from Volozhin. And as we said, until the mid-1870s, there was really not many other yeshivas of the new Volozhin model. Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector is obviously one of the more well-known examples of this. Did not go to Volozhin, went to the old Beis Medrash model type of study. But there are many, 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 many more. Another point, number two, is to mention that the most extreme manifestation of this new trend that I'm describing, that there's this challenges in the 1870s and 1880s that need new educational solutions, and the Volozhin yeshiva model seems like a great model to copy at this point, is the best example of it is not even Volozhin Slobodka or Telz. More likely, the best manifestation of this new process is the Kovna Kail, which was a completely trailblazing institution for its time. And more than any other yeshiva-style institutions, it signaled a change in the Kahila system and the adaptability of the traditional community in facing the challenges of modernity. So while a full analysis of the innovation of the Kovna Kail is beyond the scope of this episode, and it definitely deserves a fuller treatment in a future episode, but suffice to say that the idea of the Kovna Kail was that rabbis would, it was perceived by the visionary founders of the Kail, that rabbis in Russia would no longer be produced by young budding scholars marrying into a wealthy man's, marrying a wealthy man's daughter and studying for the rabbinate while under his father-in-law's support. That wasn't going to work anymore. It had worked for centuries. It wasn't working anymore. Why? Because the potential father-in-laws were usually secularizing and were not interested in supporting a Torah son-in-law anymore by the late 19th century. And even if they were, their daughters were not interested in marrying one. So an independent institution was envisioned in which independent, non-Kahal funds would be raised and budding young scholars would study there to become rabbis and be supported by this institution. And this is the modern institution of the Kohel to deal with the changing world. Lots to say on this topic. This was a conscious decision by its visionary founders, and we'll have to save the full story for another time. Another point I want to make. By the beginning of the 20th century, the new style of yeshivas became sort of a victim of their own success. Or, on the other side, also, on one hand, a victim to their own success, and also a victim to the rapid secularization and urbanization and poverty of Russian Jewish society. There simply was not enough Torah jobs and rabbinical positions for all of the graduates of these yeshivas, and many of them could not find employment. The lucky ones found positions in the rabbinate. Others immigrated to the United States and other countries and found positions in the rabbinate there. Others went into business, like the vast majority of their brethren. In other words, these are the alumni of the new yeshivas, Tel, Slabatka, Mir Valajin, Radin, whatever, the 10 or so yeshivas that existed in the Lithuanian parts of Russia at the turn of the century. Many of them could not find a job in the rabbinate and went into business like the vast majority of their brethren in the Pale of Settlement, despite the fact that they had expected otherwise due to their elite Torah education. Still others found new types of Torah positions, especially in the larger cities. Remember, this is the age of urbanization. To be a Moira Tzedek, some sort of Paisik, or Dayan, a Yeshiva Rebbe, and many similar positions. Another huge factor in all of this, which we haven't mentioned, is the detrimental effect of the Rav Mitam policy of the Tsarist government, which made it so challenging for communities to fund real religious and traditional rabbis because the government didn't recognize them. They only recognized the Rav Mitam, who was not real, not religious, and not even traditional, usually. It was more like a government bureaucrat, which is also a good story. Maybe we'll get to the Rav Mitam story in a future episode. It should also be noted that serving as a religious functionary in a community generally absolved one from the draft. So that was another important incentive in deciding where one's employment was. An important story in all this development during the 19th century is the fact that establishing an official yeshiva was illegal as far as the Tsar's government was concerned. Famously, Valajin itself had to contend with this reality for decades, the fact that they were illegal. And this legality challenge was what ultimately led to its tragic closure in 1892 by the Tsarist government, which I discussed on that series of Valajin several years ago. Quite some time ago, I discovered that the Mir Yeshiva also faced legal issues from the Tsarist government. The yeshiva was illegal, and when charged by the government in the late 1860s, the then Rosh Yeshiva, Reb Chaim Leib Tikhtinsky, tried to explain that it's not really a yeshiva. It's really a shul where some random locals study Torah. It's not an official yeshiva. It's not a separate institution. In other words, he's claiming that it's the old style base medrash form of study and not a new institution. I saw these documents myself. This back and forth between the Tsarist government and the interrogation of Reb Chaim Leib Tikhtinsky regarding the Mir's legality status. So another decisive factor in hindering the establishment of more Valajin-style yeshivas throughout most of the 19th century was the illegal nature of this endeavor and the many obstacles put in place by the Tsarist government, which often prevented its development and growth. And this is a very important point in the Russian context. Another point, which I mentioned briefly earlier, the Lithuanian Valajin-style non-Kahila yeshivas only took off near the end of the 19th century, as we've been saying. The modern style of yeshiva was seen as a valuable tool in confronting many of the realities which were facing traditional Jewry in Russia towards the end of the 19th century. Coincidentally, the Hasidic movement started investing in yeshiva education in order to confront the challenges of modernity at almost the exact same time. Taim Chet Mimim, various different yeshivas in Poland, Garen, Alexander, and others, Sachachov, other examples. definitely more so after World War One, and I spoke about that in a podcast once as well. But it started in the last decade of the 19th century. In the 1890s, the first Hasidic yeshiva started the Pale End in Poland, Congress Poland. So it's an interesting and overlooked point, because it is often said that the Hasidim were finally copying the Litvish yeshiva model, when in reality, both communities discovered the Volozhin model at almost the same time, within a few years of each other, and both communities used it in a very effective, as a successful tool to further Torah education and traditional values. The Litvish were obviously a few years earlier, because the Volozhin model was local to them, but not by much. They started opening yeshivas in the 1870s, and the Hasidim only in the 1890s, about 20 years apart. So it's an interesting point, I think, that's also overlooked. This entire episode focused on a tiny elite among Russian Jewry, the Lamdin elite, the yeshiva elite, the scholarly elite. But in a way, it reflects a certain ethos of Lithuanian Jewry in the Russian Empire, because the masses of traditional Jews still respected and looked up to this elite. And even though in practice it was a tiny fraction of the population who participated in this. In summary, ultimately in the grand scheme of things, the Volozhin story and it being the first modern yeshiva played a tiny and tiny role. I wouldn't say insignificant, but in Russian Jewry in the 19th century, as far as numbers, it was a very, very tiny role in its own time. But it has stood the test of time, and its influence would grow in the Second Polish Republic with the spread of Lithuanian style yeshivas in Poland, and even more so with the rebuilding of the Torah community in the aftermath of the Holocaust in the United States and Israel. In many ways, we always refer to it as rebuilding after the Holocaust. But in many ways, it was constructing the Volozhin model yeshiva on a grand and mass scale for the very first time, since Volozhin was established 150 years earlier. In the post-war era in the United States and Israel, the Volozhin model yeshiva for the very first time in history truly became a mass movement. That's ironic, to say the least, and it kind of goes against the narrative, but I believe it's true. If so, the Volozhin story and the unique environment of Torah study and elite education in the Lithuanian areas of Russia in the 19th century should be viewed as a sort of origin story of today's yeshiva and yeshiva community, and not as an earlier version of today's reality. So this was Yehuda Gerber with Jewish History Soundbites. You can reach me at Yehuda@YehudaGerber.com for questions, comments, sources, tours, trips, sponsorships, and lectures. You can subscribe to Jewish History Soundbites on your favorite podcast platform, and I hope you enjoyed.